From GPB News, this is On Second Thought. I'm Celeste Headley. On today's show, the rich musical landscape of Georgia, from a country music legend to an up-and-coming singer-songwriter. That's coming up this hour. First, though, we talked yesterday to the pastors from two Baptist churches in Macon. They've been separate since the Civil War. One has a black congregation, the other mostly white. They're now trying to come together. Here's Reverend James Goolsbee of the First Baptist Church.
As a result of just the interaction, the things that we've done together, the conversation that we're getting ready to have has already proven to be tremendously effective in just getting to know our brothers and sisters in Christ.
Here are your first thoughts. Joel Cook tweets, as an atheist, this is fascinating. This is so backward. I feel like this issue should have been resolved 60 years ago. And Craig Fluck adds, the two First Baptist churches are on track to correct centuries of separation. They, like us, are better together. We love getting your thoughts, so send them to us. You can call us and leave a message at 404-500-9457. You can also tweet us at OST Talk or post on Facebook, and we might feature your comments on the show. Georgia ranks 49th in the United States in the number of dentists per capita. That's according to research from Georgia State University and Georgia Tech. Not getting regular dental care can lead to some major health problems, but many people just can't afford it. Dr. Nuruddin Nurani organized the first Community of Smiles free dental clinic 10 years ago. The 10th will be held this Saturday in Lawrenceville. Good morning, Dr. Nurani.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
It's good to have you. And Andy Miller is editor of Georgia Health News. He covers healthcare policy, among other things. It's good to have you back, as always, Andy.
Glad to be here.
So you told me that last year you had about 250 people come to your free dental clinic. Is that fairly accurate?
No, that's very accurate. We gave out 250 numbers, and I think we saw 249 when one person we had to let go because of high blood pressure.
Okay, and that requires how many dentists volunteer their time?
It's about 25 dentists to come volunteer. And every year it's been more and more. This year we've kept it the same as last year.
Yeah. Okay, so I did the math. I looked up the average cost of a regular dental visit. It's about $300. That includes exam, x-rays, and cleaning. And that's average nationwide. So $300 times 250 people is $75,000 in free dental care that you and other dentists give out every year. Why?
Well, this past year we did $86,000.
Holy cow.
And so those are actually smaller procedures. We do free cleanings, free extractions, or free fillings.
Which is what takes the costs up, because that's more expensive than a cleaning.
Exactly. Well, the more costly items are when you need a root canal or a crown or something. Those are the more expensive items that lead to higher costs. If you kind of just take in just your normal, regular cleanings and x-rays and doing preventive work, you know, those typically you're going to limit those to under $400, $500 a year if you go twice a year.
So let me ask my question again. Why do this?
Well, I feel like it's a way of giving back. And I feel like due to my faith, I feel like it's a strong ethic of giving back, and I feel like it's a duty that I should be able to give back. Dentistry has been an amazing profession for me personally, and having the knowledge and the ability to give back is a great thing. I feel honored that I can provide give of my knowledge and time.
If the faith you're talking about is you're practicing Muslim.
I am.
Okay, so let me take this, Andy, to non-faith-based statistics. Why do we have so few dentists in Georgia?
Well, it's a product, first, of we only have one dental school in the state.
One dental school in the whole state?
Yes.
Which school is that?
It's in Augusta. It's the medical college there at Augusta University, yeah. That's one reason. Another thing is the fact that in rural areas, there are many counties that don't have a practicing dentist there. And that leads to a lack of access for a lot of these kids in rural areas because they live too far away from a dentist who may take Medicaid or just regular pay dentist. So those are the real gaps for people, and also seniors in nursing homes, a lot of times that they don't have access to dentists either.
Medicare does not offer dental coverage unless it's a medical procedure.
Well, that Medicaid does not. Yeah, for adults, it's got to be like an extraction, something like that. But for kids, Medicaid has pretty good coverage, but only one out of five dentists in Georgia takes Medicaid.
Well, it also Medicare. Kaiser reports that Medicare also doesn't offer dental coverage unless it's a medical procedure. Doctor, what is a medical? When does a dental problem become a medical procedure? No, I mean, I would assume that when you have to do surgery, right? Like extracting a wisdom tooth or
primary coverage is for children that you get coverage for. And I do believe they cover some extractions. But my understanding of the Medicare system is that although there are not that many providers, my understanding is that some of the dentists that have tried to enroll in Medicaid just haven't been able to enroll.
Oh, the paperwork is too difficult.
I think they said that there are enough dentists already on. And that
is shocking to me, Andy, because I read the statistics from the Health Resources and Services Administration. Now, they're talking about the whole country.
Right.
And in the whole country, 80% of the country's practicing dentists do not accept Medicaid. Okay, so part of the reason people are focusing on this and part of the reason we're talking about this is that people say we have a looming dental crisis. Why?
Well, it comes from that. It comes from the fact that we don't have enough dentists, especially in this state. It also comes, and you can see this in charity care clinics, that you can see the tremendous demand. I mean, people stand in line early in the morning to get in line, you know, for the free care, and it's something that people kind of ignore sometimes when they shouldn't. And then something gets painful, and then they need the care right then. And I think it's an access to care issue, but I also think it's somewhat of a cost issue as well. And people, you know, to be frank, people are leery of if you haven't gone for 3 years and you may have some pain in there. They think, oh gosh, I don't want to go, or it's going to be very painful.
My dentist is going to tell me that I'm not flossing.
Right.
What are the most common? Also, one in four kids in the United States have untreated tooth decay, and one in four. This is shocking. One in four Medicare beneficiaries are missing all of their natural teeth. What is the most common things problems? Not just a cleaning, but what are the most common problems that you see during the free dental care event?
It runs a full gamut. We see people that with severe toothaches. We see people that just are coming in just for their regular routine cleanings. We see people coming in for fillings, but their teeth are already bombed out beyond what we could do to fill. Those teeth actually just need to be removed. But, you know, we try to stress to everybody that comes that preventive care is kind of the way to go. If they can come in just for their regular cleanings and x-rays to kind of have things checked, you can stop those things, or you can detect those early on, and the cost of that to repair that is a lot less expensive than to where if the cavity gets into the nerve of the tooth, where they would need a root canal or a crown, or worst case, they would end up losing the tooth. So the idea is to try to prevent that from happening.
If you're just joining us, my guests are Dr. Nuruddin Noorani, our Lawrenceville dentist who runs the annual Community of Smiles free dental clinic, and Georgia Health News editor Andy Miller. Andy Miller was talking about lines of people waiting. Do you have to turn people away?
Most of the times we've had to turn people away. Last year they started lining up 12 noon the day before.
Holy cow.
And when you see that, it's just a very humbling experience. You say, oh my God, you know, all the work that's gone into this, you feel like...
And you have to turn people away.
And then, exactly.
Is it hard to convince dentists to and techs to volunteer their time?
It's not. I've had... every year we try to get more and more dentists to kind of enroll, but if dentists are available, most are very giving of their time and usually want to help in something like this, to where, you know, they just come in and would work for, you know, four to six hours and they're done with it. They don't have to worry about the organizational part of it. And it works out really well.
So, Andy, we already, the United States, as of like a couple years ago, already had a shortage of at least 4,000 dentists. 33 million people live in areas that don't have dental health professionals. Just stunning. Some of these numbers are stunning to me. But people say the shortage is about to get worse. Why?
Well, you have dentists who are retiring. I mean, it's the same is true.
The baby boomer age.
Same is true with physicians. You have a lot of older physicians, a lot of older dentists who are about to retire. And the Georgia Tech study, I think, that was done recently is very, mm-hmm. was very interesting because it found that tens of thousands of Georgia kids just don't have access to a dentist. Now, what does that mean? Well,
I want to be clear. You mean they don't have access. They don't live in a place where they can get to a dentist, let
correct.
Alone insurance. Okay,
correct.
Go ahead.
I mean, that's just a physical distance away. And so what are the consequences of that? Well, dental care or lack thereof is a leading cause of absenteeism among children. And if they continue not to get that care, you know, the smile is a very important thing when they get to be employment age. And if they don't have, you know, a good smile, a lot of employers, you know, will tend, especially for those people that are working in service industries, a lot of them will tend to gravitate toward those who do have a good smile. And so these kids are, you know, kids and adults are losing teeth because of this lack of access.
So, Dr. Nirani, I actually chatted with somebody in the line at the grocery store who does not have dental care. And she said she's not going to worry about her kids. She can't afford to take them to the dentist because they're going to lose all their baby teeth anyway, and then they can start fresh. What are the dangers of not getting your kid to the dentist?
Now, you want to diagnose any untreated cavities prior to them losing those teeth. Although, you know, it's a common thought that, you know, okay, well, just let the baby teeth, they're going to fall out anyways. But the baby teeth actually hold space for the permanent teeth to come in. So if they've lost prematurely, teeth will shift and you know, not allow the permanent teeth to come in properly in their proper orientation, thus leading to where they would have to have braces or cause further problems later on.
And braces are expensive.
Exactly.
That's a lot more than the $300 or $400 exam. We have about 30 seconds left. How many are you expecting this year? You said it's going to be about the same size.
Yeah, we're gonna pass out 250 numbers right at 6 o'clock. So whoever's in line,
6 o'clock in the morning.
6 o'clock in the morning, Saturday morning. That's September 10th. So.
Good luck. That's a long day of looking at teeth. Dentist Nordine Nirani is organizing the 10th annual Community of Smiles free dental clinic. It's this Saturday in Lawrenceville. Andy Miller is editor of Georgia Health News. Thank you so much.
Thank you very
Glad
much.
Glad to be here.
Singer-songwriter Adia Victoria has a complicated relationship with the South. She felt like an outsider as a young woman of color growing up in the foothills of the Blue Ridge Mountains, and that comes across in every guitar riff and haunting vocal. She released her debut album, Beyond the Bloodhounds, earlier this year. Adia will perform tomorrow night in Atlanta at The Earl, and I spoke with her this summer. I asked her first about a gift she received for her 21st birthday. One of her friends gave her a guitar.
It was a Washburn. It was an acoustic Washburn. My best friend, she decided to move from Atlanta to Seattle, and she was like, would you like this guitar? And I said, yes, I would like that guitar. So I started learning guitar.
And you hadn't ever really played guitar before?
Never.
So why did you want it?
I think at a time in my life, I wasn't doing much. I was working in Atlanta as a telemarketer, and I was just spiritually empty at that time. And I was like, I could learn a new instrument. I like blues music, and I think I could play it. So I just had no other options. So I just picked up the guitar and I fell in love, and I just created this own little world for me.
What drew you to blues music in particular?
I like the stories. The way that the performers were relaying the stories to the listener was completely different than anything that I'd ever heard. And of course, there's like the undeniable, like the beat of it, the very like intrinsic beat of the blues, the bass lines. But I like that they were telling me about Black lives in a way that I hadn't seen them validated externally. Like, these are people that had humor about being poor, about being dumped, about, you know, running around the countryside, like escaping their demons. And it was something that I was feeling at the time, when I started listening to the blues, and it just really struck a chord with me.
And this is about the time when you moved to Atlanta, wasn't it?
Yes.
And I read something that you described when you got to Atlanta. You said, I heard Black inner lives for the first time. Mm-hmm. And I wonder what you meant by that.
I feel like growing up as a young Black girl in the South, I had very specific messages told to me about my value and who I was, my identity, that had nothing to do with me. It was very impersonal. And the things that I was being told, I didn't feel that way inside of myself. I felt more restless. I felt a lot more uprooted. I felt lost a little bit. And there was nothing outside of me that was validating that I should feel that way, you know? And so I feel like a lot of time growing up, I had to put on like a mask of, okay, well, I'm okay. And I guess I'll be all right. But it never really connected to anything inside of me. So when I started listening to the blues, they were talking about, you know, I heard women speaking about being weird and like feeling like freaks and being okay with that and like traveling around and not necessarily living up to the status quo, but in fact, subverting it. And that made me feel for the first time like, hey, maybe I do matter. Maybe the thoughts that I have about the world do matter.
So you've written about the South quite a bit in your music, actually. I wanted to take a listen to one song, Stuck in the South.
I don't know nothing about nothing by heart. All misery.
Describe the South in a lot of really different ways. So in Stuck in the South, there's a line where you say, I don't know nothing about Southern bells, but I can tell you something about Southern hell. When your skin give them cause to take and take. So this is a side of the South that's talking about it being a place of well, obviously racism, but also tribulation, just struggle, mm-hmm. especially for someone of color. Where does this song come from? Was it just like a look back at the whole region, or was it a personal story?
It was a personal story. I wrote this song 3 years ago from my viewpoint as a teenager in high school in Malden, South Carolina, a really small town, a suburb town of Greenville. And I just remember feeling at that time in my life that I'd never lived anywhere. I'd never really experienced anything other than the upstate. And I felt stifled. I felt suffocated. I felt smothered, in fact, by my upbringing. And I knew that there was more to the world, but I couldn't really fathom it. And so I kind of, like a lot of teenagers do, you kind of turn all of your aggression outward against, you know, the little town you're growing up in and, you know, the values and what you're taught you're supposed to be. You need something to rage against. And for me, it was the South. And again, like, I just remember what society was telling me my place was, like what society was telling my value was as like a young, lower class Black girl who necessarily didn't buy into, the things that they would say validated me, like your looks or who you're dating, any of that. Like, I wasn't interested in any of that. And so I just felt completely alienated from my upbringing. And for a kid, like, that can kind of feel like an existential crisis when you feel no connection to the world around you, but also feel like oppressed by it as well.
And in a way, the way that you're describing the South in general is also the way you've talked about nature. I mean, you grew up in the shadow of the Blue Ridge Mountains, right, in South Carolina?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
But you've said that nature terrified you and that it's unforgiving. Why do you describe nature that way?
The reason nature spoke to me was because its authority superseded society's authority. You know, it didn't play by the rules that I was taught. It did its own thing regardless of what, you know, man needed it to do or wanted from it. And so I found this kind of comfort in that, and that I could appeal to nature instead of society. Like, I would go out in the little town that we were raised in, Campobello, and me and my sisters would just, like, go out into the woods and pretend like we were in a place where no man had ever stepped foot. And we would just be in awe of, like, the mountains and the storms and the countryside where there was no sign of any life. And there was something very comforting about that. Like, it just remained unmarked and unsullied by mankind. And I liked that it didn't play by the rules.
So let's hear another piece of music. This is the song called Howlin' Shame. And when I think of you as a blues singer, this song comes immediately to mind. When you began listening to the blues, who were you listening to?
I was listening to Victoria Spivey. I was listening to Skip James, Robert Johnson. These were my main three. Like, these were the big three for me. And I kind of branched outward from there. But I always come back to their work for the storytelling properties, for the musical value of it. Victoria Spivey, she was, you know, the woman that kind of gave me a shot in the arm. And I watched countless videos of her on YouTube. I think I've seen every video of her on YouTube, and I just watched her performing and her reveling in her power, and I loved it. And I was just like, I need to do that. I have to do that. And I love Skip James's, the way that he kind of explores his, I guess, his terror at his own existence, at his place in the world, his anxiety. Like, his music is so anxiety ridden. He talks a lot about death and demons moving through him, and that was something that I needed to hear. I needed people to reaffirm that these things happen, and everyone's not always going to look happy and flawless all the time. Like, there's a very dark underbelly to the human experience.
So I wonder what change it makes, do you think, in your songwriting and your singing, that you're usually holding a guitar? Would you be a different singer if you were, obviously, Katy Perry, or just somebody who just stands up and holds a microphone as opposed to usually having the guitar in your hand?
Well, I mean, I do both. There's a few songs where I don't have the guitar necessarily, but it is a different experience as a performer when you do have the instrument in your hand, because you're connecting to something else. Like, you're actually making the music. So it feels completely different for me, but I enjoy both. Like, I don't prefer one over the other. A lot of these songs came about me writing them on the guitar. So it's a necessary element on a few of the tracks. It just adds something different, I feel like, to my vocal approach even.
So here's another song, and this is perhaps the one most well-known. This is called Dead Eyes.
Since you left this town, you know, if I could beg or borrow the money, child, I'd be highway bound. I live all alone, ever knew. Little girl wouldn't say I do, but I feel so sad and blue. You know that it's all 'cause of you. I could cry, I could cry, I could cry. I could die, die, I could die. It's a lonely avenue. It's a lonely avenue.
So this video, it takes place in nature. It's almost like I was watching this video and thinking about all the different threads in this, because it's heavily laden with a lot of religious overtones. It's coming off an album called Beyond the Bloodhounds, which can't help but call up images and themes of slavery. And it's a video was shot in a really stark, I guess it was a forest, but there's no leaves on the trees.
Mm-hmm.
Tell me a little bit about the sounds of this song itself that you chose to start totally a cappella.
Yeah, well, the video starts with a cappella cover of Lonely Avenue by Ray Charles. And that's a song that I fell in love with while I was living in Atlanta. I just, something about that story of, you know, Ray being dumped by this woman and just being left in utter like despair. Like he's been like displaced after she's left him. And it's a song that I've been singing a cappella for years, since about 2009. It's just always stuck with me, and I wanted to record it. It was just my dream to record that song.
Why a cappella, though? Why do you sing it unaccompanied?
Because I wanted to sing it the way that I sang it in my room and in my head and sitting on the bus and sitting on the MARTA. And, you know, that's how this song kept me company. Like, I would walk up and down Ponce de Leon to the train station singing this song at 4 a.m. You know, that's its place in my life. And so I wanted to pay homage to that on the record and then also in the video.
If you're just joining us, my guest is singer-songwriter Adia Victoria. One of the things that I read, and please correct me if this is not correct, but it was written in your Wikipedia page that you moved to Nashville because you felt like it would be easier to be anonymous there?
I moved to Nashville because I got fired from my job in Atlanta, and I was collecting unemployment and not doing anything in my life except for sitting in my apartment in Midtown. And my whole family had moved to Nashville at this point. And my mom was like, why don't you come to Nashville and be with your family? I think that she could tell that I was slipping into a very dark place, just hanging out in Atlanta. So that's why I moved there. I moved there to be with my family. But that's one of the reasons I love Nashville, is that I have my own private life there. Like, I don't go out in the scene. I don't hang out in the nightlife. I'm not trying to be noticed. That's where I live my day-to-day life. That's where I take care of my business. And I keep my business to myself in Nashville. Like, I don't want people knowing who I am or what I'm up to. Just go away.
So,
I'm alone.
You do write about dark themes and dark places in your music. And I wonder, does your music relieve that kind of darkness, or does it add to it?
I think it relieves it for sure. It allows me to, a lot of these songs, they're relaying moments like in instances and like interactions that I've had with people and circumstances where at the time I didn't have the voice to speak to what I felt or what was going on around me. So I would go and like write a song and just like get it all out. And in that way, I kind of felt like I hadn't been like conquered by something, or I wasn't like stuck in a certain interaction with somebody or a certain dynamic with a person. Like, I can just get it all out. But then when I perform it, I try to go back to what it felt like in that moment, like where I was. And I think that affects the way that people see me on stage. It's like I just disappear because I'm not there anymore. I'm reliving these moments in my life. So it's kind of interesting. Like, I write the songs because it's therapeutic so I can work through it. But then I go on tour, and then I just dive right back into that.
Do you think of yourself as an activist? Do you think that you have a message to relay?
I think that I have a story to tell. I'm not an activist. I am living an active life, and I'm telling that story to people. And it's kind of like what Nina Simone said once. Someone asked her the same kind of question, and she was basically like, I am civil rights. Like, I can only tell you what happened. I can only tell you what's going on. That's my story, is to let you know what happened. And then from there, you guys can go out and be inspired to act on, you know, what I'm telling you. But my job as an artist is to remain open and accessible and to tell my story to people as honest as I can.
Adia Victoria is a singer-songwriter. Adia, thank you so much. It's been such a pleasure.
Thank you.
Country music veteran Bill Anderson was born in Columbia, South Carolina, but he found his voice in Georgia. He graduated with a degree in journalism from the University of Georgia and went on to spend the next 50 years becoming one of the most successful singer-songwriters in country music history, or in music history, period. He was inducted into the Country Music Hall of Fame in 2001, and his new memoir is titled Whisperin' Bill Anderson, An Unprecedented Life in Country Music. Bill will perform at the Social Circle Theater in Social Circle, Georgia, Thursday night, and he's my guest this morning. It's such a pleasure. Thank you for coming in.
Thank you for having me, Celeste. Good to see you.
So this is your second memoir. Because what happened in the 90s was this shocking development. Well, was it shocking to you when you suddenly had a resurgence of activity in the music business?
Well, I wrote my first autobiography in 1989. I thought it was over. I had spent about 30 years in the country music business, and I thought, well, I've run out of things to say. Nobody's interested in me anymore. I'm just an old dinosaur in the music business, so I'll run away and start doing game shows on television and soap operas and things like that. And then, lo and behold, about 5 years after I thought it was all done and finished, I had this resurgence in my career, particularly as a songwriter, and began this new thing for me called co-writing. I had never done much of that.
Writing with someone else.
Yes, I had written most of my songs by myself. I discovered co-writing. I discovered a whole new career. And I guess the unprecedented part that comes in the title of the book is the fact that not anybody else that I know of has really done that, had 30 pretty good years and took about 10 years off and then come back and actually had a more fruitful career the second time.
Let's hear the song that may have sort of helped kickstart the second half. This is Tips of My Fingers, recorded by Steve Wariner. It became a number one hit in 1992 in the country charts. That's 32 years after you originally recorded. In fact, your version hit the charts when Steve Wariner was only 5 years old.
I reached out my arms and I touched you with soft words. I whispered your name. I came. My eyes had a vision of sweet lips yielding beneath my
You then began a very successful collaboration with Vince Gill. What did you have to change? When you say that you didn't, you know, you thought you were a dinosaur, did you have to change your songwriting style all that much?
You know what I've discovered? People actually write songs in the daytime. See, I thought all country songs had to be written at 2 in the morning with the shades pulled down, the lights low, and you get in as miserable a mood as you can get in. But I come to find out that these guys who've come to town in recent years and who are doing so much of the country songwriting today, co-writing and all, they make appointments to write at 10 o'clock in the morning. They drink coffee. I mean, this
you
was a whole
whiskey
new
or beer.
You said that, I didn't.
I read your memoir, remember. Let's hear your first hit.
And oh, golly, do we have to?
We do. This is actually the very famous Ray Price singing City Lights. And you wrote this when you were 19 years old and working as a DJ in Commerce, Georgia. So when you listen back to some of those early songs, do you ever get the temptation to tinker, to say, gee, I wish I'd fixed this or changed that word?
Not so much in my songs. I do my own records. I cannot stand to listen to my old records. Every time I hear one, I think, why didn't I do that one more time? I could have done it a lot better. But when I hear Ray Price sing City Lights, I just sit back and grin and think, boy, I must be the luckiest guy in the world.
So you were 19 years old when you wrote that. Did you know right away when you finished it, boy, this could be a hit?
No. I wrote it up on top of a little three-story hotel in Commerce. I was in Commerce last night, by the way, and had a wonderful visit with a lot of old friends. And we talked about that night I went up on top of that little three-story hotel, looked up at the stars. There weren't but two or three traffic lights in Commerce. And I wrote the bright array of city lights as far as I can see. My dad said he knew I was going to make it if I had the imagination to look at Commerce, Georgia, and call it a great white way.
Well, since you mentioned your own singing, let's hear you singing. This is a song that I imagine most people will recognize. This is your hit Still, and you're singing here a live performance on a TV program.
No, and I'm trying to figure out where you took that from. I haven't sung that high in 20 years.
your songs are not easy to sing. I mean, some of them are quite challenging, which lends itself to some of the gorgeous voices that have sung them. But I wonder, going back to this song in particular, Still, what change do you think it makes that you're a singer-songwriter as opposed to somebody who's just writing songs for other people?
Well, I think when you're a singer-songwriter or an artist-songwriter, you interpret the song the way that you heard it when you wrote it. I've written a lot of songs that other people have recorded, and they've come back to me, some marvelous records. I mean, I'm so proud, like the Ray Price City Lights and Steve's Tips of My Fingers and things. But every once in a while, you'll write one, and it'll come back home, and you say, did I really write that? I mean, they'll change it a lot.
Okay, so let's hear an example of that. And then we'll get your reaction, try to get you to remember how you first felt when you heard this. This is James Brown doing the recover of the same song, Still. So there's another Georgia boy.
Just like I wrote it. I was so thrilled when I mean, number one, James Brown recording a Bill Anderson song. I mean, that's way outside the lines there. But I was so honored by that and so appreciative of it. And a little later on in the lyric, he actually even calls my name. He says, I learned this song from a good friend of mine, Brother Bill Anderson. And that just thrilled me to death.
And the song holds up. What do you think makes a good song? I mean, you must sit down and think to yourself, wow, this one that I've written is really good, and this one, it's okay. What makes those really great tunes?
The public. They tell you whether it's really great or not. You sit there, all you can do as a writer at the end of the day is to say, did I get everything out of that idea that was in there? Did I write it as well as it could be written? And then the rest of it is totally out of your hands. It's up to whoever finds it, whoever discovers it, whoever records it, whoever interprets it their own way. You really have very little, if any, control over that.
How do you know when to walk away from a song that you're writing?
If you look at it and you're satisfied that every little bit of it fits together as well as it can. I walk away from them. Here's what I do, and I've always done this. I will write one and get it as good as I think I can get it, and then I will put it away and not even look at it for maybe 3 or 4 weeks. I'll pull it out, and it's not really on my mind. It's fresh when I see it again after being away from it, and I look at it and I say, oh, that's pretty good. I did all right on this, or, oh, golly, why did I put it this way? Let's do it this way, or let's go back. Let's change this note. Let's change this chord pattern. Let's change this word in the song. I like to live with them. I don't turn them loose until I've had a chance to live with them a while.
If you're just joining us, my guest is country music legend Bill Anderson. His new memoir is called Whisperin' Bill Anderson, An Unprecedented Life in Country Music. If you have a favorite Bill Anderson tune, we want to hear from you. You can tweet us at OST Talk or join the conversation at Facebook. So I read that Trisha Yearwood, in her blurb for your book, said, I know Bill was born in South Carolina, but he was raised in Georgia, so I'll always own him as a Georgia boy. Is that how you think of yourself? Is that fair?
My favorite word there is boy. Well, of course, Trisha's from Monticello, Georgia, and she and I have known each other for a long, long time. She's a wonderful lady, and sure, I'm a Georgia boy. I mean, I was born in South Carolina, but my family left there when I was 8 years old, and we moved to Griffin and then to Decatur, and I went to the University of Georgia.
As a journalism major.
Well, I thought I wanted to be the world's greatest sports writer. I wanted to be Furman Bisher when I grew up. And I had the chance to tell him that one time, and I'm glad I did.
So what happened? I mean, because you tell the story in your memoir about sitting in your grandpapa's office, and he would install you there with a stack of paper and a typewriter, and you'd type away furiously all day. I mean, you seem to have been pretty passionate about it. What happened between that kid typing on that typewriter and the guy singing country songs at the Grand Ole Opry?
Well, he just grew up a little bit. I knew from the early part of my life I was going to do something that had to do with the creative arts. My loves were sports, writing, and music, country music. And I knew there was going to be some combination of that woven into my life, whether I'm a sports writer, whether I'm writing country songs, or what I'm doing. Those passions were inside of me, and I knew they were going to come out. I just didn't know in which form.
Let's hear you again. This is you singing the song Po' Folks, which you wrote in 1961. I'm told that this is the first one that really gave you an identity as a singer instead of just somebody who wrote tunes. And this is the one that led to your joining the cast of the Grand Ole Opry.
There's a whole lot of people looking down their noses at me, 'cause I didn't come from a wealthy family. There was 10 of us living in a two-room shack on the banks of the river by the railroad track. We kept chickens and a pen in the back, and everybody said we was poor folks. My daddy was a farmer, but all he ever raised was us. Dug the 40-foot wells and the 36-gallon.
So you say in your memoir that you seem upset.
Where did you find that obscure recording?
I will never give our secrets away.
I never heard that before. Sounds nothing like the record.
Oh, really? You've never heard that recording before?
No, I've never heard that before. I don't know that I ever want to hear it again. But
come on now. Come on. But you say in the book that you seem to have this attraction to writing about big families living on farms, which was not your upbringing, correct?
No, it wasn't. But I have always kind of had that as a fantasy. I always thought how great it would be to have, you know, 8 or 10 brothers and sisters and just live out in the middle of the country somewhere and, you know, raise cows and horses and pigs and turnip greens and whatever. I don't know why I've always fantasized about that, but I have.
And you also point to your grandparents on the Anderson side as one of the main reasons why you're successful and became successful. Why is that?
Well, my granddaddy, or my grandpapa, as I called him, Anderson, down in Griffin, he was an old-time fiddle player. My grandmother was a little bit of a guitar picker and singer. My grandfather on the other side was a Methodist minister. And I think you put all of those things together and mix them up in a bowl, and Whisperin' Bill Anderson pops out, I guess, all those influences in my life.
Okay, so this particular memoir, as opposed to the first memoir written in the 80s, this is focused on the career, as you say, that came after you thought you were done. You were getting into the restaurant business, I think.
Mistake number one.
So what has changed? And especially in terms of co-writing, what has changed in your songwriting? What was difficult?
Well, it was a little difficult in the beginning to walk into a room with somebody else. Songwriting, as I said earlier, for me was kind of a lonely thing. It was something I did by myself. It was very introspective. And I wondered for years, in fact, I doubted for years that I could write with somebody else, that I could walk in at 10 o'clock in the morning and sit down and say, okay, let's pour our heart into this song. And then when I found out I could, it opened up this whole new world. I found out there's people out there just as crazy as I am. See, a lot of times I'd sit down to write a song and I'd write the second verse first. And I thought, nobody does that. Let me tell you something, everybody does that. And I find out that these other artists and young writers and people, you know, they like to draw from my influences. I love to draw from theirs. They had a whole different set of influences from those that I had. And I love sharing mine with them and I love them sharing theirs with me.
That is country music veteran, legend, Bill Anderson. His memoir is called Whisperin' Bill Anderson, An Unprecedented Life in Country Music, and he'll perform at the Social Circle Theater in Social Circle, Georgia, this Thursday night at 7. It's been a real pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me. You definitely did your homework, and I appreciate that.
That's what they pay me to do. We definitely want to hear about your favorite Bill Anderson tunes. There are so many of them that I'm sure one of them strikes your fancy. You can call us at 404-500-9457 and sing it for us, of course. Or you can tweet us at OST Talk or post on Facebook. For today, that is On Second Thought from GPB News. I'm Celeste Headlee. Have a great day.